world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. It's the Oscars this weekend. Since Parasite's Best Picture win in 2020, more and more non-English language films have been nominated across the board. Could a foreign film win the top prize this year? And our obituaries editor pays tribute to the colourful, flamboyant fashion icon, Iris Apfel. But first, Haiti is in a state of chaos once more. In the past week, gangs have overrun the capital, Port-au-Prince, displacing thousands in the Caribbean country of 11.5 million people. They've attacked two prisons, released thousands of inmates, and laid siege to the international airport. The gangs have also torched police stations and broken into the country's main port, stranding truckloads of much-needed humanitarian aid. On Thursday, the government extended its state of emergency for another month. Haitians say it's hard to leave their homes, even to go to work, school or the market.
Jodi a situation peyi a an kritik. Jodi a kote population pa kapab fonksyone, population pa ka manje, population petite population pa ka l'ekòl, madan Sarah pa ka al nan machi.
And the violence seems set to continue until one man gives up power.
Haiti's most prominent gang leader says the surge in violence is targeted at dislodging Prime Minister Ariel Henry.
Sarah Burke is The Economist's Mexico City bureau chief.
Haitians have already endured 19 changes of leadership in the 38 years since the fall of the Duvalier dictatorship. They may now be about to witness their 20th.
How did the security situation in Haiti get so bad?
Haiti has long been poor and violent and fairly unstable, but this current crisis can be dated back to 2021. That summer, Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated. Ariel Henry took over as the leader, supposedly just temporarily. But Moïse's death led to a power vacuum, and the gang violence got worse, the police became overwhelmed, Mr. Henry delayed elections because of the violence. And so now Haiti has not a single elected government official, including Mr. Henry.
But Sarah, that's been the situation for a while. Why have things in Haiti become so much worse recently? Like, what was the trigger?
Mr. Henry went to Kenya last week. He was there to finalise a UN-backed agreement to send 1,000 Kenyan police officers to Haiti as part of a security mission. And he was discussing this alongside Kenya's president at a press conference there on March the 2nd.
We are facing a situation where young kids couldn't go to school and goods cannot move inside of the country. We did this appeal and you step up and you said, we want to help Haiti. Thank you, President. We appreciate it.
Gangs took advantage of his absence to try to force him from power. And this started a new round of violence. So they started shooting at the airport in particular, which seems like an effort to keep Mr. Henry from coming back. And on March the 5th, Haiti's top gang leader, Jimmy Cherizier, better known as Barbecue, told reporters in the capital that there would be civil war and genocide if Miss Donnery did not resign.
Si Ariel Henry pas démissionné, si communauté internationale là continue à supporter Ariel Henry, na y a mené nous directement dans une guerre civile et qu'a débouché sur un génocide.
How has Mr. Henry responded?
He's not said anything publicly. For a while there was uncertainty about where he even was. He's now in Puerto Rico. And there's rumors he may soon fly to Jamaica to talk to other Caribbean leaders about what's going to happen. The US's official line is that Haiti needs a transitional government and then an elected one.
As the situation on the ground grows increasingly dire, we in CARICOM have continued to call on stakeholders, including the Prime Minister, to make concessions in the interest of the Haitian people. So we are not calling on him or pushing for him to resign, but we are urging him to expedite the transition to an empowered and inclusive governance structure that will move with urgency to help.
But some reports suggest that American officials are encouraging Mr. Henry to step down now to make way for that.
So, Sarah, what comes next?
The US says it wants to fast track the planned security mission with the Kenyan troops. But it's not clear how quickly that can actually happen. The political will, both in and outside the US, seems to be lacking. The other issue is obviously what to do about having some form of government. Mr. Henry had promised elections by August 2025, but obviously this now seems far too little too late. The current idea is having a transitional government with a prime minister ruling alongside a judge who would act as the president. Or the alternative formula would be a presidential council with people from various different parts of society representing Haitians. But many Haitians are skeptical this will help. It's just another formulation of unelected officials.
Well, will it help?
I mean, there are two parts here. First of all, could a transitional government and a security mission, assuming they arrive, help curb the gang violence? Probably, yes. We spoke to a Canadian diplomat with lots of experience in Haiti who says that gang members are often teenagers who are being paid very little and would run away if faced with professional soldiers. But the second question is whether the security mission and a transitional government could actually stabilize the country and find a political path forward. The most recent UN mission, which left the country in 2017, did help stabilize things. But it came with a high cost for many Haitians who remember it for inadvertently introducing cholera, which killed many people, and also several cases of sexual assault by troops against Haitians. And this time, Haiti would need to be totally rebuilt, including holding elections, and that's a lot harder. There's not really much state left to be stabilized.
Sarah, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Ore.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
I'm deadly serious.
You might remember Parasite, a 2019 South Korean film about a low-income family in Seoul that infiltrates a rich household.
Max Norman is a culture correspondent for The Economist.
Parasite ended up sweeping at the Oscars. It won 4, including Best Picture, in 2020. It was the first time a foreign language film had won the top prize. But since Parasite, an international title has been nominated in the top category every year. And this year, there are two.
Okay, Max, it's the Oscars this weekend, and tell me, how well represented are international films in this year's nominees?
Well, if we look at the Best Picture category, it's the most international lineup yet. There are two international films nominated for Best Picture, Anatomy of a Fall and Zone of Interest.
Tell me everything.
Yes.
Anatomy of a Fall, a French courtroom drama about a murder trial in a mountain town. And Zone of Interest, about Rudolf Hess and his family, the Commandant of Auschwitz. There's also a third film that we should mention, which is Past Lives.
There's a word in Korean
Inyeon.
It's an American film, but it's about 70% in Korean. So if it was produced abroad, it would actually qualify by Oscar rules as an international feature. It's notable that these are three films that are in another language with subtitles, which is normally something which struggles a little bit in the American market. In addition to these three films, it's a pretty diverse lineup generally in terms of nationality. Nearly half of this year's nominees in all categories are originally from another country. Some of them live in Hollywood, but these are people from abroad, which just points to the increasing internationalization of the film industry more generally. Hollywood has been internationalizing for years, and it's overdue that we see that reflected at the Oscars.
So what spurred this newfound appreciation of international film?
So you may remember in 2015, this discussion really exploded into the public eye with a hashtag, #OscarsSoWhite. It was that year, for the first of what would be 2 years in a row, all 20 of the acting nominees were white. And it really struck a chord with a public that had been energized by the Black Lives Matter protests that really had erupted the summer before. The discussion quickly at the Academy included not just racial and ethnic diversity, but also diversity in terms of nation, country of origin. The Academy, like any members-only club, has long favored well-connected and older white men, most of whom live in Hollywood. In 2015, its membership was estimated to be 92% white and 75% male. So they were eager, clearly, to deflect negative publicity and also, let's hope, to welcome in a more diverse membership. So they took steps to move beyond the demographics of the 90210 postcode. In the past few years, they've actually have made concrete changes. The share of membership from underrepresented races and ethnicities has more than doubled. And now about a fifth of Academy members live outside of the US.
But has this more diverse membership had an impact on which films actually win?
It's really hard to say what causes what at the Oscars, but we can see from the outside that after Oscars So White, the look and feel of a Best Picture film did begin to change, whether that's Moonlight in 2017 to last year, Everything Everywhere All at Once. The message is clear. The Academy doesn't look like it used to, and increasingly it doesn't think like it used to either. We might see films reflecting more diverse casts, more diverse storylines, and so on. We also are starting to see a different taste that might reflect the increasingly international membership. Many Hollywood films might feel foreign to non-Americans who are voting. So the swing towards global film is very visible in the Best Picture category, but it's also evident in other categories as well, particularly if you look at the Best Documentary Feature Award. This year, for the first time, the documentary branch hasn't nominated a single American production.
How are the critics and the audiences responding to this change in focus?
Critics, I think for the most part, are pleased. People who like to go to their art house cinema, who are interested in cinema as an art form, who use the word cinema in the US rather than film or the movies. Audiences and some industry insiders may be a little less happy. Some think that the Academy does itself no favors when it crowns foreign, independent, and niche films for Best Picture. There's kind of a sense of existential dread, I would say, maybe a bit too strong of a word, at the Oscars. But there's definitely some questions about where the Oscars are going and how they're going to survive in the media landscape. The viewership for the annual ceremony has been on a downward trend for years, and it's pretty striking. In 1998, when Titanic and LA Confidential battled it out for Best Picture, 57 million Americans watched. Last year, though, only 19 million Americans tuned in to see the Oscars. The divide between the Oscar winners and the Oscar watchers can only be so wide. People need to be interested in the Oscars for the Oscars to have its prestige, have its clout. If the American public isn't invested, whatever sort of artistic pretensions the Academy might have to crown, you know, the most worthy film or the film that is most interesting for the art form, they don't mean very much if the American public actually doesn't buy in.
Could an international film win Best Picture this year?
Well, it's technically possible, but it would be really surprising. Oppenheimer seems to have been coasting towards victory for months now. It has been a clear frontrunner for a long time. It's a great movie. It's an epic movie. Christopher Nolan has also never won an Oscar. The Academy may want to finally give him a well-deserved victory. It will also please industry traditionalists who want to see a blockbuster win. But regardless of who wins, international cinema has already won.
Max, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Iris Apfel had white hair.
Well, so what? She was in her 90s. What did people expect?
Anne Rowe is The Economist's obituaries editor.
Anyway, she liked her hair white or grey. She had wrinkles far more on her face than any serum or powder could obscure. But that didn't bother her. What the heck? If God had given her all those extra years, why not celebrate it? There was anyway very little you could do once you got old. Your hands would always betray you. And there was always some part of your body that ached when you got up in the morning. But she knew the cure for all those annoying feelings. Just get up, do the necessary, and get dressed. Now, when Iris got dressed, it didn't mean just opening a wardrobe. It meant wandering into a perfect labyrinth of clothes and accessories. Thousands and thousands of pieces that she'd collected over the years. So many that she didn't even bother to put them in cupboards, but had them hanging on pipe racks. And she would muse through them all and think what she wanted to wear that day. It wasn't an intellectual exercise, it was a gut thing. So she would pick out a colour, then another one that would clash with it. She liked clashing, she didn't like matching clothes. And when she had put, say, a tunic on over pyjamas or a couturier suit under a chasuble or all kinds of mixing and muddling clothes, she would then go to the accessories and she would hang round her neck huge beads or silver plates that came down and lay on her chest like armour. Then her two trademark things. First of all, bright red lipstick, because she loved the impact it made. And then very big, round, dark-framed spectacles. They were her real trademark. She was not a character you'd miss on the street. But then her fame had come very late. She was 84 when suddenly the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York called her and asked if it could put some of her pieces on display. And she imagined they just wanted a few accessories to sit in a vitrine. But when the team from the museum came and started to go through her huge collection of pieces and opened all her boxes and her armoires and rooted about under the bed, they got so excited that she ended up having to dress 85 mannequins. The exhibition, which finally came about in 2005, was a huge sensation. It was called Rara Avis, or Rare Bird, and suddenly Iris was the talk of the town. She had been apprenticed first to a decorator, and there she'd learned to make something out of nothing. Then she began to get interested in fabrics, and the company she founded was called Old World Weavers, and it would look everywhere in the world for old and interesting, rare fabrics, and then get them replicated on a mill. She started decorating the White House under Truman, and she was still doing it when Bill Clinton came. She had a good reputation already in New York, but she would play it down and say she was just a woman who put cushions on sofas. She grew up through the Depression and the Second World War, and the family all knew how to paint and sew and glue and generally make things when there was very little money about. It followed then that she had an enormous love for discount stores and any way she could save money. She would make a great pilgrimage, really, when she was quite young, 11 or 12, to go into Manhattan and go round her favourite discount stores, which were S. Klein in Manhattan and Lohmann's in Brooklyn. And there she would just look about for cheaper things that she could look fabulous in. There was no market she wouldn't visit, and she was the fiercest haggler and always insisted on getting everything she liked. She would not give up until the stallholder was so worn down that he just Let her take it away. People often asked her what the secret was of staying so energetic and vital and constantly colourful into old age.
You guys looking beautiful. Irish looking beautiful. You guys are wonderful.
Well, she would say she didn't drink soda, she didn't eat fatty foods. She'd been lucky in having a long and happy marriage. But the most important thing was having a child's eye and keeping that curiosity and wonder, because the world was full of treasures and you simply had to notice them. She'd always been curiously interested in spectacle frames, and she'd collected them from when she was a child and just put them away in a box. The time came at last when she was having to wear spectacles all the time. She did so partly, of course, to advertise herself and her fashion sense, but also to tell everyone, keep looking and keep being amazed by the world.
Anne Rowe on Iris Apfel, who has died aged 102. That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. The show's editors are Chris Impey and Jack Gill. Our deputy editor is John Joe Devlin. And our sound engineer is Will Rowe. Our senior producers are Rory Galloway and Sarah Larniuk. Our senior creative producer is William Warren. Our producers are Maggie Kadifa and Benji Guy. And our assistant producer is Henrietta McFarlane, with extra production help this week from Jonathan Day. We'll all see you back here tomorrow for the weekend edition of The Intelligence.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.